Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. There's a core belief here at Living Lab Radio that we don't really stop to talk about much, and that's that science can provide factual information that can help us make better decisions as individuals, communities, and as societies. But why should we trust science? How can we be sure that what we learn today won't be proved wrong in the future? Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science at Harvard University, and she takes on these types of questions in her new book, Why Trust Science? Naomi, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks. Nice to be back with you.
Let's just start with your own personal credo, which you put into the book, about why we would actually want trustworthy science.
Well, I'm very influenced by Pascal and by the notion of Pascal's wager. So many centuries ago, the great French philosopher and mathematician Pascal decided that the greatest scientific question of all was actually not a scientific question. It was the question of whether or not God existed. And he reasoned that you could think about it in terms of what we would now call a type 1 and type 2 error. What are the consequences of believing in God if there is no God, and what are the consequences of disbelieving if there is? And he reasoned that the second one is much worse than the first, because if God really exists and we disrespect him or her or it, we could be in a whole heap of trouble, literally a whole lot of hot fire and brimstone. So therefore, he wagered it was a whole lot less risky to believe in God than not to believe in God. And so that's a kind of backdrop for me in terms of thinking about science, is to think about the risks of rejecting science that's true versus the risks of accepting science that's false. And I argue that in our current world, with the threat of climate change bearing down upon us, the risk of ignoring what scientists are telling us is very, very grave indeed.
You also point out that we've seen in the past few years a perhaps unique rise of distrust in science and a role that distrust in science is playing in our federal government, but also these, you know, words that we've heard like truthiness or alternative facts. What is the current state of trust in science and how different is it?
There's good news and there's bad news here. The good news is that despite a lot of panic and alarm being raised, all of the available evidence tells us that the vast majority of American people still do trust science, and we trust science much more than we trust government or politicians or, I'm sorry to tell you, journalists. and we also know, if we look at, say, the General Social Survey, we have good data on this in the United States going back about 50 to 60 years. We see that trust in all institutional authority has declined since the 1960s, but trust in science has actually declined much less than many other institutions. The bad news is that there are these particular areas in which people reject science, and they reject science, and we have good evidence on this, when they feel or fear that the implications of the scientific findings clash with their values, their deeply held preferences, their worldview, their economic interests, or their religious beliefs. And we also know, and again, this is something that is new and different about the recent situation, although by recent, I don't mean the last 3 months, I mean the last three decades, we have witnessed the rise of the deliberate exploitation of scientific uncertainty by interested parties. So in the areas of tobacco, climate change, a number of other environmental public health issues, we, and when I say we, I mean literally me and Eric Conway and other colleagues, have documented the way in which interested industries have deliberately tried to stoke distrust in science in order to protect dangerous products and dangerous economic activities.
And we should be clear that you are not pushing for blind trust in science. Naomi Oreskes, in this new book, Why Trust Science, you spend a lot of time actually differentiating between trust in science and trust in scientists. And a few minutes ago, you said, you know, people trust science more than they trust politicians, which seems to be kind of mixing those, right? Why is it so important to distinguish between science as an enterprise or a body of knowledge and the people who do it?
Yeah, good question and good catch, right? So I should have said trust science more than government or business or journalism, so right? Because this is a very key point. So my argument is twofold, that the basis for trust in science should be two things. One is the sustained engagement that scientists have with the natural world. Scientists dedicate their lives to studying and understanding the natural world. And in doing this, they develop a particular kind of expertise that the rest of us do not have and really pretty much cannot have unless we were to go back to school and get PhDs in that particular field. So there's a claim for expertise. What I want to argue is a valid claim for expertise, and that the validity of that claim is often not attended to, I think, as much as it should be. The second reason is that science as an enterprise has a set of mechanisms for vetting claims, for judging claims, for putting them up to tough scrutiny, and for really asking tough questions about what is this claim based on? How much evidence is there? Is the evidence of high quality? Is the evidence compelling? And a scientific claim is not accepted as true until it's been broadly accepted by the community of experts, plural, based on this process of vetting claims. And so my argument is that the reliability of scientific claims emerges through that process. And at the end of the day, if we have a process about which scientific experts say, yes, we have a consensus the climate's changing and it's caused by greenhouse gases, or yes, we have a consensus that a diet that's very heavy in processed meat is, you know, very likely to be less healthy for you than one that doesn't include processed red meat, these are likely to be highly reliable claims. So it's not about trusting the individual scientist. And in fact, I think we should be fairly leery of any individual scientist who puts himself or herself too much front and center, although our celebrity-oriented culture makes that inevitable to some extent. But we should have some confidence in this overall process.
Well, let's talk about some of the cases where it does not necessarily work as well. We have heard a lot in recent years about things like the replication crisis, the fact that many studies, when people try to go and replicate an experiment, it doesn't come up with the same result, or the fact that peer review, this process of vetting scientists' different work, is maybe broken or not working as well as it should be. We hear about high-profile cases of misconduct or fraud. How should we still trust science in light of all of that?
We trust science by putting those examples into context. And again, this is one area where I'm sorry to say, I think journalists, present company excluded, of course, have really done a disservice. Because if we have a case of fraud or if we have a case of a high-profile study that can't be replicated, this is exciting to people. This seems to be significant. And we've seen a lot of media coverage in the last few years of some very dramatic claims about, for example, the replication crisis. But if you actually look at the data, what we find is that these examples are really exceptions that prove the rule. They're actually staggeringly rare. In fact, they're rarer than I thought when I started doing this work. So, you know, you hear people talk about the skyrocketing rates of papers being retracted. You know, and from that, you might think, I don't know, maybe half of all papers are retracted, or at least a third or a quarter. And it turns out the actual retraction rate is something like 0.02%. It's tiny, 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 tiny. You know, if I were an athlete and my error rate was 0.02%, I'd be pretty darn happy. So actually, we have a process that is working very well overall. There are some areas in which we have evidence of larger problems, like psychology. But I do think these are particular areas where we can identify particular problems, and I don't think they generalize to science as a whole. And more important, not just what I think, we have no evidence to support the claim that they generalize to science as a whole.
Naomi Oreskes, the argument that you make in Why Trust Science is kind of a nuanced one, though, because while you're arguing that we should trust the process and the overall collective end result and the well-vetted body of work, not the individuals, at the same time, you're not arguing that what we would want to aspire to is an inhuman version of science, that in fact, you say it is the fact that this is a social, collective, human endeavor that is the greatest strength of science. What do you mean by that?
Well, thank you for appreciating the nuance, because one thing that is hard about working in this area is that science is a very complicated thing. It's diverse. The different sciences are not all the same. They don't all use the same methods. So one of the things I tried to do here is to give a sense of the texture of science. And as you say, to make the argument that the human face of science shouldn't be viewed as something that we have to hide. And I say that for two reasons. The first has to do with the social processes of vetting. So my argument here, which draws on a pretty rich literature in feminist philosophy of science, a literature that I think has been underutilized by a lot of other people, which is to say that feminists have argued that for scientific claims to be robust, we have to look at them from a lot of different angles. That's important because we are human beings and all human beings have blind spots. So if I personally am vetting a claim, or if me and a group of friends who all think the same way vet a claim, there's a good chance there'll be a blind spot. And the obvious blind spot in the history of science is gender bias. But if we diversify the scientific community, we bring in women and people of color, and maybe people from other countries, maybe people from different class backgrounds, we increase the odds that our claims will be examined from a lot of different perspectives, and that will help reduce the risk of blind spots. So a big, complicated, messy human community of different people who think differently is a good thing. And that's a strength of science, not a weakness. So the image that many of us have of the scientist as a white man with a white lab coat, it's not only false historically, but it's actually a bad image epistemologically.
Naomi Oreskes, another maybe ingredient that you argue we should put into the mix a little bit more when thinking about science or maybe hearing from scientists is values. And I think we tend to try to completely separate and say science is without values. Values is the realm of religion or politics, something else, but it's not part of science. And you say, no, part and parcel of science being done by human beings is that values are embedded in science, and we actually need to be more open about that. What would that look like, and how do you see that playing out in a way that does not somehow lead to fragmentation and distrust of science?
It's definitely delicate territory, and that's why in the book I try to walk gracefully and gently and in a nuanced way into this territory. But I think it gets back to what you said about the human face of science. Science is done by people, and people necessarily have values and preferences and aspirations. And if you deny that, then you're saying something that is untrue. And I think, and this comes in part from my extensive experience now being on the lecture circuit, talking about climate change and other value-laden issues across the United States, people don't believe it if you say, I have no values. And you know what? They're right. They're right not to believe it, because of course you have values. So I think when scientists pretend they don't have values or that those values have no effect on what they do, I think that comes across as lacking credibility. And I actually think that contributes to distrust. So even though many scientists think that it's important not to discuss values for the very reasons you just said, I actually think that it's not working. I think if anything, it might backfire. But if you're open about the values that have led you to work on the issue in the first place, then what I have found is that it's actually a way you can connect with people. Because the reality is that as much as we talk about being a divided country and we talk about red states and blue states, there's an awful lot that all of us have in common. For example, in my experience, all of us who have children love our children and want our children to be safe and healthy, and we want our children to have opportunities in the future that are as good or better than we ourselves have had. I have yet to meet any person with children who doesn't feel that way. So that's a place where you can connect with people. And if you can connect on the issue of values, then that opens a space to say, okay, well, let me explain to you why climate change is so important for all of us who love our children. And I found that to be a remarkably effective way to open a space to communicate with people who might otherwise think that they don't have anything in common with me.
So a little bit of advice for those, you know, seeing scientific studies and scientific information in the news and elsewhere in their daily lives. How do you figure out what to trust and what to leave aside?
Well, it's not easy. And part of the book is to say to people, you know, if you feel that this is difficult or you're feeling frustrated, you're right. It is difficult and it is frustrating and it's not your fault, right? And part of the book is to help people to say, I'm going to be here and kind of walk you through this. And so one of the take homes is to ask yourself, who is making this claim? Is the person making the claim about science actually a scientist? Because if you start to ask just that very basic question, what you discover is that an enormous amount of stuff on the internet, on Facebook, in media, even in supposedly reputable places like the New York Times and the Washington Post, there are all kinds of people making scientific claims who are are not scientists. And the minute that happens, that should be a red flag. So if Jenny McCarthy starts telling you about what causes autism, you can say, well, she's a nice lady. I'm sure she loves her children, but she's not an expert on autism. Second red flag is then to go to the next level, which is, let's say the person actually is a scientist. Now you ask yourself the question, okay, but are they an expert on this issue? If you see someone talking about something for which they do not have appropriate expertise, that should be a red flag. And you can rule out a lot of nonsense and disinformation in just a few minutes by taking that one step.
Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science at Harvard University, and her new book is Why Trust Science. Naomi, thank you.
Thank you so much. Pleasure talking to you, as always.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.